Okay, so we are now in the middle of the process. There's difference between revealed truth and my trying to package things. So you could have 20 different elements of the relationship between a counselor and a counselee, between a disciple and a teacher. You could boil it down into three or whatever. I'm just breaking it for these convenience sake. Okay, so we've talked about getting involved with a person. How do you develop proper involvement that avoids sexual manipulation, other kinds of manipulation? Obviously, same-sex counseling is probably preferable. Not that it's wrong to counsel somebody the opposite sex, but it's fraught with all kinds of dangers. But lesson 9 and 10 for tonight. First, second key element of biblical counseling, the facts, ma'am, nothing but the facts. Key elements of biblical counseling investigation. So in other words, okay, when you try to help somebody, what do you look for? This boils down to that. What information do you need to know if you're really going to help that person? And here's some suggestions from Jay and some things that I've modified. Okay, to show how to get the data needed to counsel. Now imagine someone asked me to direct him to, say, the Console Energy Center. I didn't know the directions. Or I interrupted them before they finished telling me. It would be kind of foolish, wouldn't it? Because I would be trying to answer a question that I really don't know what the question is. So Proverbs says this. I think it's Proverbs 18:13. Somebody want to read that for us? Proverbs 18:13. Right. Okay, whoever answers a matter before he hears it to him, it's what? Folly, shame. So, again, that would come from pride, that would come from presumption of trying to answer the question before you know what it is. So truth or facts in counseling are not options. Now, it's not sitting as a judge, but when you think about it, people come in, say a typical husband-wife, they're fighting, they have disagreements. In a sense, you're sitting as a referee between them. You're sitting as a judge trying to determine what's fact, what's not fact, what's spin, what's not spin. Okay. So you need to be aware of that. The importance of truth is all through the Old Testament, especially in the case law, where you're required to investigate thoroughly, and make your decisions on facts, not, your guesses. So first thing here, they're not just useful, they're morally necessary. You need to know what facts for which to look. I'm still the old school, you don't like to end the sentence with prepositions, but people do, so that should be corrected. What do you look for? Jay Adams points out, when somebody comes in, they tell you their problem, not always, but often in Western culture, in terms of what? Emotions. I'm depressed. I'm upset. I'm angry. So they're presenting to you the situation as they experience it. And he says it's important for you to understand that, but to move also to what he would call the performance. Okay, I'm not getting along with my wife. Well, yeah, of course you're not getting along with your wife. You're running around with another woman, and you're getting drunk and you're wasting the family's money. Okay. See, that's the presentation level is, hey, I'm getting a fight with my wife. Things are not going well. I want you to straighten it out. The performance is what he's doing. Does that make sense? Same thing, but from a different aspect. What's going on that creates the hassles? Okay. So that's the performance aspect or level, if you want to call it that. And then there's what he calls preconditioning, maybe not the best term, but, you know, is it habitual? So let me give you a quick example. A gal comes in, Christian parents, raised in a Christian home. She says on her intake sheet, my problem is that I'm gay. Ask her some questions and find out that she was working at Planned Parenthood. Not a good idea, but she's working at Planned Parenthood. And there, an older lesbian is basically hitting on her over a two-year period. She never gets involved with this woman. Oh, you're so sensitive, and, you know, gays are much more sensitive than straights. And, you know, just the way guys ply, you know, this gal's plowing her to try to get into bed with her. Doesn't ever respond, right? 2 years, doesn't respond. She moves on, kind of more of a typical American kid, like, well, I wonder if I am gay, right? How will I know, right? So what'd she do? She goes out one night stand, gets involved with somebody, and, you know, parents find out and ask her to come in. And I did say it in a gentle, kind way. So your problem is not that you're gay. You know, biblically speaking, your problem is you're foolish because you don't know who to listen to. You know, you're listening to people who are trying to take advantage of you as opposed to parents and others that really, you know, really care for you. See the difference? This is not habitual for her. Yeah, she had a sexual encounter for which she had to ask for forgiveness, and she had to get that washed out of her system. But her biggest problem was, who is she going to listen to? Is she going to listen to God and parents that loved her, or is she going to listen to goofy people in the world that are trying to, you know, rip her off? So that's what I mean by, here's the performance. Yes, she was involved in homosexuality. That's different if you got somebody that's been in a gay lifestyle for 30 years. That person, you can say, well, that person's gay, or whatever term you want to use. They're homosexual because they've lived that lifestyle. It's their character. I don't know about you all, but we tried to teach our kids, don't call people a liar until you see that they're habitually lying. Then you can put a tag on a person. You see the difference? You know, a person who goes out, I've had kids to go out and get drunk. That's bad. But it's, you know, around prom time or whatever, it's bad. But they still go out and drink. But that's not a lifestyle. Whereas there's other kids that are getting drunk every weekend or getting high every weekend. You know, that's different. So you want to find out whether or not this is a one-time thing or whether this is an ongoing pattern. And then I add that fourth one there, presuppositional. What's the person really believe? You know, what does the person really believe about God, about himself, other people, about their problems? Because that whole belief system is what really is going to drive that person. You know, people who believe God helps them that helps themselves don't understand grace. Other people who have a welfare mentality, you know, assume, well, people got to give me something. You know, that's a very different. What are their belief system? And that's what you really got to get to, changing that person's heart. That young girl had to realize, look, I can understand truth. Let's go back to the garden, right? Did Adam and Eve know right from wrong before they sinned? Of course they did. Who said yes? Very good. Why? Yeah. And I'm sure when he said, don't eat or you'll die, Adam might go, what's death? And the Lord must have at least said, don't want to go there. You know, you just don't want to experience it. It's really bad. So this idea that, you know, they really didn't know right from wrong until they actually ate of the tree, you know, that was a lie. They knew right from wrong. They knew what they should do. And listening to the lie got them into trouble. So analyze when a person comes in, look at this aspect. What's going on? Is this habitual or just temporary? And what's the real belief and heart that goes along with this. Hey, if I don't do this, then it's just not going to happen. You know, if I don't beat my kids into conformity, you know, they'll never come around. Well, yes, you ought to discipline your children, but even the best discipline in the world won't convert your children. It's the grace of God being faithful to his covenant. So I hope that makes sense to you. Examine it from all those different angles to get a fairly good picture of what a person's doing and why the person's doing it. Because we'll see later, people won't change unless they're convicted. It just won't happen. If a person isn't convicted, this is what God wants me to do, and it's worth doing what God wants me to do, no matter what the consequences are. Even if I suffer for it, it's better to suffer for doing what's right, you know, than to get off the hook for doing what's wrong. See, that's what we have to develop in people. So know the facts, okay? And B, under that, you need to analyze the person's several levels. And here's just a quick acrostic that Wayne Mack came up with. Preach. It used to be Peach. He added R. And knowing Wayne, he's probably got a couple other letters in there now. But, you know. Physical. What condition is this person in? Do they suffer from low blood sugar? Are they diabetic? Do they have particular allergies? You know, their physical condition. People who have brain trauma. In other words, people who have been hit in the head. Sometimes they have a very difficult time, if not impossible, doing sequential, you know, step-by-step thinking. You know, and people have to adjust to that. So what's the physical condition? Does the person eat properly? Do they eat too much? What kind of food do they eat? Do they get any kind of exercise? You know, do they have prevailing physical conditions that could affect, you know, could affect the counseling? And sometimes that happens. I had one woman, was very, if I can do this in a short compass, she was 14 years old, was pregnant out of wedlock. Talked everybody into, this is my first pastor before I got there, talked everybody into marrying this guy. This guy, you know, ended up doing time for gang raping somebody else. Was an inveterate gambler, womanizer. I remember sitting in their apartment in Easton, Pennsylvania years ago and saying, you need to divorce this guy. You know, because he's sitting there saying, why should I give up other women? She'll never put her foot down. So I said, well, you need to say simply, it's me or nobody else. Or, you know, you hit the highway. Because I'm not going to share you with other people. So that woman, later on, interestingly, horrible situation. You can see, a very bad situation. She was having projectile vomiting. Maybe she's got a brain tumor. This is back in the 70s. They did whatever they did at that time. I forget whether they had PET scans or whatever. Didn't find anything. You know, she was then in a psychiatric institution, and they were going to give her electroconvulsive shock therapy. And doctor of internal medicine who was doing a psychiatric rotation came through, looked at her, and he says, "I want tests run on her. I think there's some. She did have a brain tumor." Okay. So you could see with horrible situation like that, where you do a preliminary take, you know, on the physical condition. And she had a discrete physical problem, a brain tumor, which, you know, all the repentance in the world isn't going to get rid of the tumor. You know, and all electric convulsive shock therapy is not going to help a brain tumor. She needed the brain tumor taken out. So there are times when physical problems are 90-95% of the issue. And if you find that out, get the treatment, you know, you've taken care of the problem. So some people act bizarrely for different reasons. David acted bizarrely, remember, to get out of, forget where it was with the Philistines. Don't we have enough nutty Philistines that you got to bring this Israeli nut in here? Yeah. Because David's going, I'm dead meat if I stick around here. So I got to get out of town. So he acts crazy, gets out of town. So you can act crazy purposely, you know, to get out of a tight situation. Or you can act bizarrely because you're actually seeing things that aren't there. You know, your body is telling you things. You know, if you see things are flying off the chair, you know, you're going to put your hands up. Well, to everybody else, you look nuts. But, you know, that's an appropriate response if you're seeing those things. So physical, resources. If you're working with a person, do they have a good family? Do they have a good church? You know, do they have close friends? You know, can somebody step in and help you keeping that person accountable? And what help is available to the counselee? Three, emotion. What's the typical emotional response? Do they get angry? Do they get depressed? Do they flip back and forth? It's helpful to know how people usually respond to situations. that can be helpful. Action. It affects feelings. If I gave you 2 hours off, what would you do with it? Some of you might go to sleep, or I would at this point. But if you have, say, 2 to 5 hours, what would you do? Some of you would go on, you know, the internet and look up, you know, sports or whatever, pull it up on ESPN. Others would start looking at the stock market. You know, how you live your life is significant. So the more I know how a person uses his or her time, the better I have a picture of what that person's like. Okay. Conceptual, again, very similar to the presuppositional, as I said before. What does a person think about God? What does a person think about their family? What do they think about life? What do they think about sickness? What do they think about tough times? Those are very significant things in terms of how people face life. And you've met some of those people, right? You love being near them. Why? Because they love the Lord, and they're just usually always happy. Why? Ah, so I die of cancer. I just get to heaven faster. I mean, that's the way they are, right? You know, they really have the joy of the Lord, and you love being around them because just the way they think really is so molded by Scripture. You know, and that's different than the person who, you know, always sees defeat. You know. And lastly, history. Some people think that biblical counselors are not concerned about people's history. That's not true. If you've embezzled $10 million, I think that's significant. I need to know that. You may think it's under the blood, you know, but I think your company probably wants to be paid back. You know, that could be very significant. If you've been molested or beaten as a kid, you know, that's significant. We just don't think people are bound by their history. You know, that's all. So preach. Just all these different things. The more you can know about a person, and again, I just crack up, sometimes outwardly, but not usually, when somebody comes in and goes, I don't want to talk to my pastor. Well, why do you want to come to me? Because you don't know me. I'm thinking like, you throw away 20 years, you know, of experience with your pastor that knows you inside and out. You know, that's valuable. That's not to be thrown away. I understand why people think that way, but the more I know about a person, the better I'm able to craft, you know, what I'm going to do to help that person. Okay. Any questions on this before we go on to how to get these facts? Yes. To the situation. In other words, a physical impairment, or it can even be on the other side, something that's really good. Some people are really great athletes, but they depend on being a great athlete, you know, to get out of trouble. I mean, you've seen kids like that, right? I had one that lived with me, still does, but yeah. Nothing can ever happen wrong. Well, yeah. I mean, hello, you're riding a bicycle 13 miles down Allegheny River Boulevard to go down to Bidwell, and you don't think this is bad? I mean, have you ever ridden on, you know, Allegheny River Boulevard? Some of you don't know. It's not a great place to drive, let alone ride a bike. Okay, but you know, my son would do that when he was a little kid in kindergarten. He'd run right up to people and dodge at the last minute, or you know, go around them or whatever, and scare the daylights out of the other kids. You know, but there's somebody who has an impression that nothing bad can happen to me. I mean, that's very significant. It's just I shouldn't talk about my son, but you know, like. One day when he's five, right, we used to play Nerf football, me on my knees and him, you know, we play it in the living room, right? And all of a sudden I get this impression, he actually thinks he beats me. You know, I'm trying to let him win, so he, you know, bad mistake. Paul, I'm telling you, no, I'm better than you, Dad. Okay, so we play, right? I play as hard as I can, I win 100-0. Of course, he doesn't make one inch of, you know, yard gain or whatever. He still won't admit that I beat him. And that's a significant piece of information about that kid and how he perceives the world, you see. And I have to craft the information I give and the questions that I use differently with him than one of our daughters who you look at her and she falls apart. You know, wonder if they came from the same place. They did, but, you know, I was there for the conception. I was there for the birth. But, you know, I mean, these kids are as different as night and day. I mean, you couldn't get any different. Sometimes they look at each other and kind of go, where did you come from? You know, they're very, very different. See, so you have to craft for the individual. just other things too. The more you know about a person, for example, if somebody is not a good reader, don't give him John Owen. Okay? Even if he's a good reader, probably don't give him John Owen. Okay? Because the bottom line is, you know, the sentence structure is incredibly, you know, difficult, and, you know, give him a pared down version or one of these, you know, Owens, you know, for dummies or whatever. The Enemy Within or Through the Looking Glass by Lundgaard. So you have to craft. I always tell people, look, if a person doesn't read, don't give them a book to read. Duh. You know, but how we do that. And that's the kind of thing that teachers have to do. They have to craft for the individual student. And that's, of course, a problem in regular classrooms because my argument is classrooms are for the teachers, not for the students, because how are you going to manage 30, 35 kids? You have to conform them, you know, to your schedule or whatever. You can't handcraft, you know, particular educational needs for those kids. So that's what I'm talking about, the individual needs, a lack of reading or a lack of reading in a particular language. Yes. Sure, yeah, you would do that, and you would definitely, unless you're really thinking that the person is really a manipulator, let's say he's a violent manipulator, a wife beater, or you know, molesting the kids, you know, you would be up front unless you have some suspicions and you're trying to build a case. And you know what I'm saying? You investigate and you're asking, you're taking notes. If you have that suspicion that there may be some reason to withhold some information. But normally speaking, you're straight up front with the person and ask them straightforward questions. If a person is lying, it may be because they're afraid. You know, they don't want to tell you that the husband's beating them, or that especially if the father's molesting them. You know, then that would be a special case where you would have to try to, do the investigation, in a different context. Okay, let's move on to the number two. You need to know how to get these facts. Okay, PDI. Okay, that's just, Jay Adams called this a problem. Okay, a personal data inventory. In the back of your syllabus, if you turn back there, here's an intake form. Let me see, I think yours is on page 85. You see that personal data inventory? Name, home phone, address. It's appendix 3, forms used. 84, okay. We've got a difference. Name, home phone, address, place of employment, work phone, marital status, education. See, this is sort of some of the same stuff in a different form. Health information, very good, average, declining. Weight changes recently, lost or gained. List all important present or past illnesses or injuries or handicaps. Date of last medical examination. What was the report? Physician's name and address. Are you presently taking medication? Yes, no. If yes, what medication? Have you ever been arrested? You know, that's kind of a zinger in there to catch people off guard, but yes. We want to make sure any serious incidents in the past have been dealt with in a biblical manner. State circumstances. If the counselor believes that it would be helpful to see your social, psychiatric, or medical reports, are you willing to sign a release of information form? You know this with all the medical suing of today, you have to sign forms, to get information. Religious background, denominational preference, membership, church attended in childhood, religious background of spouse, do you believe in God, do you pray, are you saved, how frequently do you read the Bible, you ever have regular family devotions, et cetera, marriage and family information. So you have this PDI form, and if you don't know a person, you can ask them to fill it out before they come in, or you can email it to them and have them, mail it back to you so that you have access to this information. Okay. And as you go through this in the first case, you'd be looking and say, there might be a problem there. Look, they were just divorced. Well, obviously that might become a problem. Information about children. Children by a previous marriage. So you see all this information is general background information. That's what the PDI is. So you can use that or you can adjust it. Let me give you how you adjust as you go on. I'm 65. I've been ministering now for, almost 40 years. When I first started out working with Jay Adams back in the late 60s, I would be grieved if I was working with a young couple and they would have premarital intercourse, either with each other or with somebody else. I'd be surprised in a negative way. 40 years later, I am shocked pleasantly if a couple comes in for premarital counseling and they haven't had relations. That's how different things are in 40 years, even in church culture in America. So it's not on the form, but certainly now I would ask that, for a couple. Even a married couple, I've been married for 30 years or so, I say, look, did you guys have premarital intercourse or did you do things that either or both of you thought was over the line? Because that impacts people. So, you know, this is a fluid kind of thing. I mean, this isn't set in concrete. You can add things, take things out, use them, differently or whatever. But that's a template that you can use. The second thing that Jay Adams talks about is a DPP. And that over on page 41 or 40 or whatever will be for you under lesson 9. That's discovering problem patterns. It's just a simple thing, a grid work, morning, afternoon, evening. And say, I get angry. You do? Do you know what you get angry about? No, I just get angry. Okay. Tell you what, every time you get angry, write it down. Write down where you were, the circumstances, and how you handled it. They come back, and Sunday, went over my mother-in-law's for dinner, got in an argument. Wednesday night, went to prayer meeting, got in an argument with my mother-in-law. Thursday night, went over for Thanksgiving dinner, got in an argument with my mother-in-law. I think you have a problem with your mother-in-law. My mother-in-law, of course I don't. So here's a person who, if you ask them the right questions, they would say, oh, yeah, I've got a problem with my mother-in-law. But they may not see it. And you just track that. People do different sins for different reasons. Sometimes I'll give you the extreme. Sometimes people will commit adultery just because they don't have their sexual desires under control. I've seen other situations where we've had to excommunicate an elder's wife, where the sexual adultery had nothing to do with sex. Had everything to do with revenge. I'm going to bust his chops. How can I bust his chops? Well, committing adultery. Oh, and I'll pick somebody of an ethnic, background that he really hates. So if you're talking about sexual reasons, you're barking up the wrong tree for that woman. So discovering problem patterns, that woman might have discovered and said, well, look, you've got a real bitterness against your husband. Let's deal with that. So there's all kinds of creative ways to get information. One of them, the best way, is to ask people. I love seminarians. I've spent most of my life trying to train them, but they really shock me at times. I remember one guy out at Westminster, California, he goes, how in the world did you ever find that out about that guy? I said, I asked him. And his response, he wasn't a dumb guy either. He goes, you can do that? Come here. I want to smack you. Of course you can ask questions. That's the whole point. You can ask questions directly in the room, but you also can ask people to bring the information back to you. Someone says, hey, we're in trouble financially. Well, how bad? Really bad. Well, come on, how bad? Terminal. Okay, come on. Bring in your records. How much money do you make? How much money do you owe? Let's get a handle on this. Let's not just talk in these vague terms. You can give that person a homework assignment of saying, you bring in your financial records so we can find out where you really are and how bad it really is. And before we send you off to Dave Ramsey, we'll have to figure out what you're struggling with. So homework, lists, bring in records. You asked that about checking with other people, saying, do you mind if I bring your parents in? Oh, no. Well, why? Why would you not want me to talk with your parents? Or why don't you want me to talk to your pastor? That's one. Now, when we do that, since we're not a church, down at the counseling center, though we're under the seminary, we always ask that, as you can see in that PDI. Pastor's name, address, phone number, can we consult with them? And if the person says no, immediately I want to know why. What is it that you're hiding, that we don't want to go to your pastor? What's the problem? 99 times out of 100, I'll want to do that. Every once in a while, I'll run into a situation where I don't want to talk to the pastor. Had one time where the guy came in and said, "I don't want you to talk to my pastor." I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, he's my uncle." I said, "Okay." I said, "Tell you what, I'm not going to talk to him." He says, "Why?" I said, "Well, because, you know, he thinks I'm a heretic, and I'm pretty sure he is." It was a United Pentecostal, you know, Jesus only, no Trinitarian, you know. So, you know, I didn't want to be nasty or anything, but I said, "Well, I'm not going to talk with your pastor because your pastor would probably tell you not to come here anyway because, you know, I'm giving you the true gospel." So all these things, fill out the PDI, keep records. When are you tempted to get drunk, to go get high? What triggers it? You know, keeping those records, just keeping a little, you know, a little book, you know, the little flip top, a spiral bound, you know, notebook, and just jot down when these things happen, what you were thinking, where, you know, what did you feel, what did you think, you know, what did you believe about this situation. Observation. You can pick up information by just observing people. Okay? That's someone who's been trained militarily or, you know, police work. You know, certain neighborhoods I would go in with fear and trepidation. You know, I wouldn't walk around Homewood at night. I drive through. I'm not afraid of it. We can't get people to come down because we're on the edge of Homewood. But the bottom line is that's okay with me. I don't have a problem. But obviously I would not walk around in the middle of the night in Homewood. Not a real smart thing for a white guy. Yeah. The halo data, people's actions, you know, can tell you how they dressed, how they look. I'll tell you one. This is a cute one. It actually happened. But have a woman call me in San Diego. "Hey, my pastor says I should come and see you." "Okay. What's the problem?" She said, "My husband." "Oh, okay. What's the problem?" "He's mainlining, you know, speed." "So that's a serious problem." "Well, are you an expert?" I said, "Well, no, I'm not an expert, but, you know, we have helped people." And, "Well, okay, I'll come on down." So it was actually the RP building, the Reformed Presbyterian Church building. There's an old one. You know, the pocket doors that slide into the wall. And a real little narrow room, okay? And we're sitting there, and I have this huge desk, you know. And they're on the other side. And I'm praying. I smell alcohol. Well, I know I haven't been drinking. See how brilliant I am? So that eliminates me, right? Okay. So as soon as I get done praying, I look at him. "Sir, have you been drinking?" "No, I haven't." "Have you been..." I mean, now we're down to one person, right? "Have you been drinking?" "Yeah, what's it to you?" Yeah, she could have knocked me over with her breath, okay? You know, so that little smell, you know, gave an indication something wasn't right because you're not supposed to be drinking early in the morning. And, of course, I said something which interesting. So, "Well, it looks like we got two people with a similar problem." She went off like a Roman candle. After about 45 minutes, she hauls off and smacks the husband in the face, and I had to ask her to leave. You know, halo data like that. I'm praying once. A kid who went to, did he go to Moody? I think he might have been going to Moody Bible Institute. But God told him to walk around like Isaiah naked, you know, or Ezekiel naked, you know. Yeah, Chicago. It's a tough thing for God to tell you to walk around naked in Chicago. You know, and he believed in perfectionism, right? Okay, so I take him to 1 John chapter 1. If we confess our sins, he's faithful and just to forgive us. And, you know, well, I'm praying right before he leaves, and I hear he's thumbing through pages. I know where he's going, right? Deeper into 1 John where it goes, "Whoever is born of God cannot sin because the seed of God remains." And sure enough, that's where it was. So little things like that. Now, be careful. Culturally, okay? Body language is different in different cultures. I teasingly say this for my Southeast Asian friends, especially Koreans, you know. You know, when they're smiling and they're bowing at you like this, you know, this doesn't mean they're happy. This means they're in front of their professor and they're scared spitless, okay? You know, and so if you take this smiling and bowing behavior as, you know, happiness, you're wrong, okay? All kinds of different cultures. I remember going to Vietnam to teach a couple of years ago, early 2000s, and there was a great advertisement for a bank, a British bank, and they had the same thing in different cultures. Like they had grasshoppers, America, pest, you know, Vietnam, food, you know, feet up, you know, and don't ever do that in Thailand. If you put your feet up like this in the airport and show the soles of your feet, it's like flipping somebody off. So you would never know that, but culturally, so be careful, you know, you see body language, but it can be significant. I'll give you one of my ones that I have deep perception into human nature. When you have a teenager sitting like this, that being interpreted means you can't fix me. Okay? And I usually tell them, hey, there's two people that don't want to be here. You and me. Because they want me to fix you and I can't fix you and you don't want to be fixed. So let's work on this to get out of here. Okay, so halo data, guilt, depression, drugs, okay? And of course the main one is question answering. Have you ever played the game, the animal game with your kids? Yes and no. You know, a kid or you figure out an animal. And say, is it a mammal? Yes or no, okay? You know, is it a carnivore? Because they got to know what the terms are, okay? But that kind of game is what we all do. Hey, what's your name? Where do you come from? What church do you go to? And how long have you known the Lord? It's just part of our natural phenomenon where we ask questions. And that's what we want to do when we're trying to get information. Now, again, people get confused, and I have to tweak this. Jay does not say, and we do not say, don't ask why questions. But if you want to ask motivation questions to pressure someone, make sure you're ready to do that. If you want information, right? Think of the teenager. Why did you've all experienced this, right? Why did you do that? And what's the answer?
I don't know.
Right? The bottom line is don't ask a why question if you want information. Ask what, when, where, how questions. Then you can get into the questions later when we get to the heart, you know, motivation. So extensive. I can't do it here, but you know, tapping for studs. Don't. By the way, you probably should use the electronic ones, you know, because I've used the metal ones, and you can get fooled on that. Because we had a cast iron pipe in my bathroom, and when I hit that thing with a hammer, it was really racked up my elbow. Okay, so get the electronic ones, but you know. 16 on center, you're trying to tap and find out where those studs are. And extensive questioning. Okay, you're depressed. What about home? What about church? What about work? What about school? That's extensive. And then intensive, when you find an area, then you begin to ask those specific questions. Okay, you're having problems. You and the missus are having a problem. What are typical issues that you argue over? And what's the usual resolution, if any? See, that's intensive. It's kind of like cutting the calf, I call it. You've seen that. If you want to get a particular calf or cow out of the herd to brand it, you have to cut it out and get it isolated. And when you're asking information questions, you want to isolate. Okay, here's the two or three areas in which the person is experiencing conflict. And the more I understand about the conflict and the person, then I can better fit a biblical answer to that particular issue. So those are some of the ways of getting questions or responses before we take a break. Yes, Doug. Okay, very good. Very good perception. Okay, go back to that. You say, what, was 85 or 86? Okay, now, if you read J. Adams' first book, okay, it's not technically his first book, but his first book in counseling, which was Competent to Counsel, he speaks there, and always did, of schizophrenia, bizarre behavior, most probably and possibly occurring because of physiological problems in a person's central nervous system. And there's a man who's still alive to this day. His name is Hoffer. And in that, these are questions from the Hoffer-Osman diagnostic test. Hoffer-Osman diagnostic test. Okay? Active, ambitious, self-confident, to describe yourself. You know, they're on my, you're 85, did you say? 86? 86, yeah, mine 87 here. Okay. Have you ever felt people watching you? Yes. Do people's faces ever seem distorted? Yes. Do you ever have difficulty distinguishing faces? Do colors ever seem too bright? Are you sometimes unable to judge distance? All these things may indicate some perceptual problems that a person might have. So these are like 10 questions out of 145. So at the very beginning, we were always trying to screen people for possible physical problems that need medical care. See, and that's where they come from. But it's truncated compared to the... So if there was a high incidence on this, then we would give them the rest of the test. And at that point, try to see, you know, if there were. And if there was some problems, we would send them to a medical doctor. Now, Hoffer still talks about brain chemistry and brain allergies, you know, whether he's accurate or not, but that some people do have extreme food allergies that affect them mentally. Or we have one child that was diagnosed as having neuropsych Lyme. You know, Lyme borealis is the tick-borne infection, and that usually affects you joint-wise. But in this particular case, it was cognitive hallucinations and the like. So, you know, that's why we ask, are there physical problems? If there's some indication. One of the things that I always try to do, I still haven't nailed it down here. San Diego, I had a doctor, Christian doctor, that I worked with. I'd send people to him for diagnosis because he was a good medical detective. He didn't want to just know symptoms. He wanted to know cause. And so I would send him, you know, for workups, and then he would go, I think this person has a physical problem that needs to be treated, you know, physically, as well as get the counseling. So that's where those questions come from. Yes? Well, you know, I broke one of my things that I said the first night. You shouldn't be shouldn't try to be counseling somebody that's under the influence of drugs or alcohol. You need to get them sobered up before you try to deal with them. But that took me by surprise because I didn't expect her to be there. At that time, we were actually charging because we weren't independent. We were still under the old ministry, CCF in Philly. And so I gave her money back. I said, look, you know, you got a complaint here. You know, take your money back. And she said, I was just going to see my pastor. I said, I'd be very happy if you go see your pastor. But they never came back because she was bummed out. She said, I need more care. She said, I need understanding. I get more understanding out of my 12-step group than I do here. Yeah. And what I was doing was basically trying to build hope over a half an hour, saying your husband can change. This isn't hopeless. But, you know, she was under the influence and she was in no way recuperable at that point. So it did break down. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Well, yeah, I would get them to a good physician and say, look, there's cognitive loss here. You know, could you run down what might be the possible cause? You know, especially if it's runs in the history of the family. You know. But, you know, I think to do good biblical counseling, if at all possible, I mean, if you're a missionary in Papua New Guinea or, you know, you're a missionary in Uganda, you may not have access to good medical care. But, you know, we need to do that as best we can, yeah.
Two separate questions about presentation. One, how does the counselor present, basically, verbally, culturally, and do you have many patients who will, with affect, say, happy, what they're saying, their words are angry.
Well, that happens. Yeah, it happens in our homes. Are you okay? Yeah. You know, come on. No, I'm fine. Leave me alone. So, yeah, I mean, the main thing we work with is words and the content. But, you know, when people are angry or seem to be angry, you may need to say, I don't understand. Have I offended you in some way? You know, have I offended you? You know, you seem to be edgy. Am I doing something offensive to you? Always assume responsibility that it might be you. So, well, let's take a break and we'll come back. Yes, yeah, two.
Yeah,
good.
The
I just try to be, I try to be me.
Okay.
You know, if you're a happy guy, be happy. You know, if you're serious, be serious. Just, you know, don't try to be somebody you're not. Now, again, I mean, if somebody, you know, just had their wife die, you know, don't go be telling jokes. You know, be sensitive, you know, to where the person's at. But, you know, it's like preaching. Hopefully, you know good preaching when you hear it, right? And sometimes it's totally different. The one guy's a good preacher, but he's different than the other guy, but it's still preaching the word and preaching Christ. And you appreciate them for who they are, but it's through that person. And so within, you know, proper decorum, you know, you just have to be yourself. I use humor because it means a lot to me. I try to use it appropriately, you know, not in the midst of a serious situation, but, you know, sometimes I'll try to use irony and, you know, with a person kind of go, come on, let me get this. You are really going to divorce your wife, run off with this other woman, and God's going to bless you. That's very interesting. Okay, here, tell you what. You stay here and let me leave. Why? No, you stay here, give me a 20-minute head start. Because when God starts dealing with you, there might be collateral damage. And I want to be as far away from the fallout that I can be, you know, when God starts dealing with you. You know, I've done that with the pastor. I said, I can't believe you're saying what you're saying. So, okay, we'll come back and we'll jump back in that if you have any follow-up questions.